For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and once again, Hannah has stepped in to produce the show while Robert is recuperating. Coming up this week, Polly Crosby leads us into the haunting world of the illustrated child. Booker shortlisted authors Douglas Stewart and Avni Doshi discussed their debut novels and what Booker recognition has meant to each of them. And we end with Polly Crosby and the books of her life. That's all coming up in today's Read On. The Illustrated Child is Polly Crosby's scintillating debut novel, and I think it's destined to become a book club favourite. It weaves a haunting tale of loss and loneliness with the wonder of reading and the thrill of a treasure hunt. Beautifully atmospheric, it's set amid the fenlands of East Anglia, from where Polly joined me over a rather ropey internet connection. Polly Crosby, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
For those who haven't yet picked up The Illustrated Child, can you give us a bit of an insight into the plot?
Yes, of course. It's about a father who creates a series of picture books starring his daughter, Romilly. And fans of the books think that there's a treasure hunt in their pages. And they start coming to the family's village and digging in all the fields nearby, looking for gold and the treasures that they think must be buried there. But as the daughter gets a bit older, she begins to realise that her father has actually left her a dark secret in the books. And it's not a treasure hunt for gold jewels, but it's a special code that she's got to try and find out what it is.
And the code is written into the beautiful illustrations that you describe that are as much part of Romilly's father's books as the words themselves.
Yes, exactly. The novel itself is not illustrated, but I describe the paintings in as much detail as I can, which I think a lot of the reviewers so far have said it's a lovely way of being able to picture a picture without being able to see it. So yeah, that's something I was particularly keen on because the book is about painting and art and I wanted to get that across.
Well, it's something that really struck me as a blind reader who was listening to the audiobook, that you do paint beautiful word pictures. I could see Romilly's father's illustrations in my mind's eye.
That's brilliant. I'm so glad you said that. It's a very visual book, so there's lots of descriptions and colour, and I hope that comes across. I think a few readers have said they would like at some point for there to be an actual illustrated version. But what I love about books is that you create the images in your mind. So as lovely as an illustrated version would be, it's not the point of, because everyone reads a book differently.
And a lot of the clues of the book are hidden within those pictures and are things that Romilly and other readers don't necessarily notice at first glance.
Yes, exactly. And as the reader of the book, you're sort of taken along in this treasure hunt. So you're finding things out, and initially things that don't look like they mean anything will suddenly become more important as the treasure hunt goes on.
Romilly and her father are living alone in a very isolated part of East Anglia, and there is a history, a dark history, to the family setup. Her mother does make an appearance, but not for long.
Yes, it's a family of secrets, and there is a lot of happiness and a lot of sadness in the family. And I think the area, the landscape reflects that because it's a very isolated, very wild, but very beautiful place. And I think that goes very well with how the family are, how unusual they are and the secrets they hold.
Well, yes, and the landscape is as evocative as some of Romilly's father's painting. It's a landscape you're very familiar with. I believe you grew up in Suffolk yourself.
Yes, I did. And it's based on all the lovely times I had as a child going out, being wild, running free in the reed fields and the marshes. Yeah, it's a very nostalgic part of my life.
Romilly's father also rather reminded me of Roald Dahl. He has a rather twisted, violent view of life that undercuts his obvious kindness and love for his daughter.
I think that's wonderful. I love Roald Dahl, and I love the dark side of all of his stories. And I think because I was writing about a children's book, I suppose that was something that struck me, that I wanted it to be fun and exciting and colourful, but also a little bit dark and a bit eerie and a bit weird. And Romilly's father is in some ways the most incredible father, most loving man, but in other ways he's very wrapped up in the paintings he's making and the books and the secrets that he's hiding. But actually you see two very different versions of him. You see the father that Romilly loves, who can do no wrong, and the adult that isn't necessarily being the best father.
It could be quite a lonely existence for Romilly, but she has a friend who she has a slightly awkward relationship with, who she roams the Suffolk countryside and coastline with.
Yes. Well, Romilly has two friends. She has Stacey, who is a local girl who's a bit of a wild child, and she has a cat called Monty. And they are her only companions, really, other than her father. And Stacey is, she's a real tomboy. She loves getting out there and getting dirty and muddy and looking for treasure and doing all the brilliant things that you can do out in the countryside. But she's also quite domineering and can be a bit of a bully towards Romilly. So the friendship isn't easy.
We have to be careful here not to give any spoilers, but I was very entertained by the preoccupation of the great British public with the idea of this wonderful treasure hunt, and treasure had been hidden for them to find, and they emerge with their sandwiches and their metal detectors. Is that something that you saw firsthand when you were growing up?
Yes, my dad had a metal detector. We lived in a very touristy little seaside village. And at the end of every day, the tourists would go home and we would go out with the metal detector searching for all the coins that had fallen out of their pockets.
Modern treasure.
Yeah, exactly. It's the best kind. Who needs antique gold rings when you can find a pal?
As I said, I thoroughly enjoyed the audiobook version, which is vividly brought to life by Rosie Jones.
Oh, yes.
Brayer was an ancient farmhouse. A month of living there had still not unearthed a fraction of its secrets. As I ran from the house, tugging on unfamiliar wellies, I stared up at its mossy roof and dirty walls. Dad told me that it had probably once been called Brother Farm, but time and the soft Suffolk accent had changed it. The house itself was long and low and surrounded on three sides by a moat clogged with cowpats and slime. In the middle of the water was an old fountain. Perched atop it was a gargoyle with a sinister, winking face. It ogled me as I ran past, its eyes bulbous and staring. On the south side of the house, down an overgrown path, stretched a bumpy meadow filled with sagging grass. It was the perfect base for my newly invented invisible army and the edge of my territory. I could go there on my own, making pretend campfires and having sword fights with prickly bushes, knowing that I was safe, even though I could barely see the house above the long, scratchy grass. As I set off down the path towards my camp, a sharp whistle brought me back. Dad was stooped in the back door, his huge shoulders nearly touching the frame on either side. Something small and snow-like was curled up in his open palm.
"What is it?"
"I wanted to draw one, so I thought, why not?"
he said, planting the tiny kitten into my eager arms, and suddenly it was mine.
"It's a Siamese,"
he said, wiping his hands on his trousers, leaving a snail's trail of white fur on the corduroy.
Rosie Jones narrating The Illustrated Child by my guest, Polly Crosby. Polly, are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I am, but I'm very picky. I think the choice of reader makes or breaks a book. And that's why I'm so, so happy that Rosie Jones did my novel, because she's got that perfect childlike feeling about her voice. And yet she's also able to do the male characters and to create this wonderful sense of wildness and nostalgia.
Yes, she's got a real ethereal quality to her voice, hasn't she?
Yes, very much so. I was so pleased when I heard it. I jumped around the room.
And of course, one thing, unfortunately, that the narrator can't bring to life is the cover of the book. So for a visually impaired audience, can you describe the cover?
Of course. It's a partially finished painting of a young girl with glorious red hair. Her hair and her top are painted and the bottom half of her is sketched. So it's as if an artist has come along and started painting her and then given up for some reason. We don't know why. Below that is a huge splodge of the most delicious pink paint. It looks like icing on a cake. And it says on that paint, "The Illustrated Child." It's a very simple cover and quite stark, and it gives me shivers.
Did it chime with your view of Romilly's father's art?
Yes, very much so. I think Romilly's father is an incredible artist, but he's also quite a sad person with lots of things going on in his mind that we don't necessarily see straight away. And I love the fact that the drawing on the front of the book is almost abandoned. It's as if whoever has painted it has got angry and given up or decided it's not good enough. And I think that really, really works with the character of Tobias Kemp, his father.
It's a very odd position for a child to be put into, to be the subject of their parents' written or illustrated work. And I know some children like Sophie Dahl have written about it. Is that an area that you researched or that you just felt drawn to write about?
It's interesting what you say about Sophie Dahl, actually. I hadn't made that connection, but I'm going to have to go and find out what she said. I think it's very interesting because from Romilly's point of view, she has become famous and it's very exciting and everyone knows who she is. But actually, there's a darker side to that because her father, as much as he loves her, is using her for financial gain. And I suppose you could draw comparisons with people who use social media and have their families on their photographs of kids when they're little and things, and they don't necessarily give their consent, do they?
No, absolutely. And Romilly certainly runs up against that with rather grubby journalist who keeps popping up from behind hedges. Her life is public property.
Yes, very much so. And initially she loves that, but as the book goes on and as she gets older and begins to understand more, then it becomes very hard for her because she can't go out with her friend Stacey into the countryside anymore because there are so many treasure hunters and so many strange people following her around that her world grows smaller and smaller until at last she can hardly leave the house.
Yes, actually, I suppose the haunting that starts within the house spreads to the entire surrounding area because her life has been made public.
Exactly.
As I say, it's a very haunting book. Are you working on another haunting tale at the moment?
I am, yes. I'm just about to start editing my second novel. It's set on an island in the North Sea and it spans nearly 100 years. It's about a family who live on a very wild, unusual island. And that's something that happened one day in the 1950s that changes everything. It deals with mutation, ghosts, strange goings on. And it's definitely got that same flavour that The Illustrated Child has. And I'm really, so far, really pleased with how it's going.
Well, I hope you'll come back and talk about the new novel when it's published.
Oh yes, I'd love to.
In the meantime, Polly Crosby, thank you so much for being a guest on the show and introducing us to the vivid and haunting world of The Illustrated Child.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Illustrated Child by Polly Crosby is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library and it's well worth a read. And Polly will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. Douglas Stewart is a Scottish-American author whose novel Shuggy Bane is one of four debuts shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. It's a heartrending account of poverty and addiction set in 1980s Glasgow, a place that Douglas knows well, as he told me when he joined me from his home in New York.
Hi, Red, how are you?
Very well, thank you, and many congratulations on being shortlisted for the Booker Prize this year.
Ah, thank you very much. Yeah, it is such a huge honour.
You are one of four debut novelists on the list. It must have come as quite a surprise.
It certainly did come as a surprise. You know, as a debut novelist, I spent most of my time worrying if my book would actually be published, never mind recognised on any prize list. It took me about 10 years to write Shuggy Bane. And actually, when my agent was sending it out for submission, it was rejected about 32 times. And so to actually see it on a prize list, even when it made the long list, I was just really floored.
And it's also being translated into at least 11 languages so far as well.
Actually, as of today, it's about 22 languages, I think, or it's certainly creeping up there. Croatia was the latest, which is really fantastic. And then also for a book that is written in quite broad Scots, it'll actually be in both Korean and Japanese, which blows my mind.
It's very much located in Glasgow in the 1980s. But for anybody who hasn't had the pleasure of picking it up yet, could you just give us a quick introduction to the story?
Absolutely. Shuggy Bane is actually a portrait of the Bane family who are living in 1980s Glasgow. It is a love story at its heart, but it is the love story that looks at how children can have a very unconditional, tenacious love for parents who are a little bit flawed or who are suffering with addiction. We follow the mother of the family, Agnes Bane, who is a very beautiful, driven, ambitious, but a little bit proud and a little bit vain mother. And as her marriage is starting to come apart, she finds herself slipping into alcoholism. At the beginning of the book, everyone sort of thinks of Agnes as being too much. She is too much, she's exhausting. But actually, it's not that Agnes is too much, it's that the world around her is not enough. And so after she is sort of abandoned by her husband in a coal mining town that is similarly being shut down by the Thatcher government, she starts to slide into her addiction. And it is her three children, Catherine, Leek, and then the baby of the family, Shuggy, who stay by her side and try to save their mother from herself. Now, as Agnes is a little bit isolated, Shuggy, her youngest son, is also isolated because although he's a very young boy, he is growing up to be not like the other boys. And everyone around him very quickly identifies him as no right, as what they say in the book, just meaning he's very sort of precocious. He's a little bit effeminate. And so it's really this lovely portrait of love and how people cling to each other to survive as Agnes and Shuggy try to make their way through the world.
We follow the Bane family over the period of a decade as they disintegrate. Yet that bond between Shuggy and Agnes becomes stronger and stronger. At times, I did wonder why the book wasn't called Agnes Bane. She is the linchpin of the story. Is it because Shuggy is the survivor that he takes the title role?
Yeah, that's exactly it, Red. I think children are always the hope of their parents. And because the book looks a lot at 1980s Glasgow, but also, as you say, about 40 years in the history of the city, we see people go through an awfully difficult time. And we are pitched towards, as the reader, thinking about what the future might be. And Shuggy in that relationship is the future. Agnes's fate, and I don't mean to sort of spring it on the reader, so I almost reveal it from the very first chapter, is she is doomed. She is in a really difficult position. And so Shuggy for me is the little part of her that goes on and continues into the future. But even Glasgow itself is a character in the book, and I wanted really to show that. It was an incredibly difficult time in the city when the book is set. You know, the Thatcher government dismantled a lot of heavy industry, which was the main employer of a lot of working class men. And we saw unemployment skyrocket up into the 20% and stay there for quite a long time. And so even as I was writing the book and thinking about what was happening socially, I hoped that there was enough hope in the book to make you hope. I hope there was enough hope for Shuggy's generation that was to come.
Yes, there's a real howl of pain over the dismantling of the work framework within Glasgow. And yet, as you say, there's hope for something different. Shuggy dreams of being a hairdresser whilst he's working on the grotty deli counter of his local supermarket. He's hoping to escape to somewhere else.
That's right. We leave him at the end of the book and we meet him at the beginning of the book, and he's 16. And even though he's sort of been harassed and quite harshly bullied for being what we would understand as queer today, he hasn't yet come into his own manhood and explored his own sexuality. And so it not only talks about his socioeconomic hopes, but also his hopes for inclusion in society and acceptance as a young gay man.
Part of the reason he does survive is that he doesn't take the easy escapist routes, which are represented by decisions made by other members of the family.
That's right. It's about the tenacity of love in that way. The book asks the question of all of us of how far would you go to save the person you love the most before you have to save yourself? And so we see all three of Agnes's children sort of wrangle with that and wrestle with that question. And actually, Leek, the middle son, almost makes the greatest sacrifices. He almost furloughs his entire future and his dreams for himself of going to art school. But it's Shuggy that stays by his mother's side the longest. And I think that is really true of a lot. You know, I grew up in Glasgow of the 80s, and I think the thing I haven't told you yet is my own mother suffered with addiction. And when I was a child, she actually died of her alcoholism. And so I write a lot about the feelings of that pain, that exhaustion that children can feel there from the inside. Although the book is absolutely not a memoir, it is a work of fiction. I understand it because I've lived the same sort of similar life that Shuggy did. And he is clinging on to his mother till the very end.
That raw personal emotion really comes through in some of the scenes. I'm thinking especially when young Shuggy is tending to his mother just before she wakes up, fixing her some water, some milk to calm her stomach, and the dregs of the remaining drinks from the night before to stop her pain and shaking. And I found myself crying listening to that. It's lived experience that can only be written by somebody who's seen it firsthand.
Thank you, Red. It is also a book made up of lots of very small, intimate moments. The book actually starts to become quite political and looks a lot at a society that is struggling, but I'd actually only set out to write a very intimate story, a love story between a mother and son. And I knew what it took to love an alcoholic and how it could warp all these really small, ordinary moments that children might never experience. How you have to take care of a parent before you can take care of yourself. That sort of dread you might feel when you come home from school, and before you go into the house, you're kind of looking at the tilt of the lamps and how the curtains are drawn or not drawn, and listening for small sounds. And so I just wanted to, as much as I possibly could, bring the reader into the room and allow them to experience that, to sort of see it almost from Shuggy's point of view.
You say the book broadened out into something a lot more political. Was that, in a sense, looking for someone to blame, or was that trying to make sense of what had happened to your own family and others who had been through those same years?
That's a wonderful question. I think we could talk about that all day. First of all, when you are a child and you go through the trauma of unemployment, the trauma of being overlooked, the trauma of being gay in a patriarchal society, and also what it means to love and lose a parent from addiction, then a lot happens to you that you don't really have control over. And so the very first thing about writing a book is the writer has control, and especially when you take sort of a lot of pain and make it fiction. And so for me, writing the book gave me a lot of ability to access my pain and access my trauma, but also to take control of it and to twist it into whatever I saw. But also, in a way, I'm a huge fan of working class literature. I'm a huge fan of West of Scotland writing, but I'd always known it to be centered around a man's point of view, a working man or a young man's point of view. And I'd never known that to be the world or the Glasgow that I knew. As the queer son of a single mother, my entire universe was women. I was raised around women, whether those were women on the housing scheme or whether there were other women that my mother socialized through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew women to be the strength of the city, but I rarely got to read about them and their children in these huge West of Scotland books. And so when I say I didn't want it to be political, I really did want it to be an intimate story about what it meant to be a woman in the time, what it meant to be a young queer boy in the time. You can't really set a book in Glasgow in the 1980s without addressing the political, without looking at unemployment and addiction and mental health issues, and also the failed 1950s and 60s housing scheme design that then started to crumble by the 70s and 80s. And I tend to think of it as a bit of an ecosystem that maybe isn't very healthy or working. I think we talk a lot about the book, about some of the misogyny that is coming from the men towards the women, and sometimes also from the women towards other women. There's a lot of harsh judgment on the character of Agnes placed by women that believe themselves to be very upstanding Catholics within the housing scheme. But it's a sort of ecosystem that's struggling because the men are expected to be incredibly narrow in how they can perform their masculinity. You know, they're expected to be hard. They're expected to hit before they're hit. One of my favorite characters in the book is actually Leek, the middle son, who is a very sensitive boy. He is a heterosexual man, but he is quiet, he's reserved, he's gentle. He is overflowing with empathy. And as I said, he puts aside his own dreams of going to art school in order to look after his younger brother and make sure his mother is also okay. And so for all of that, for all of his sensitivity and his gentleness, he finds himself outside of society and as a real loner in a way that is very different to how Agnes and Shuggy are alone. And, you know, he's just a real reflection of not being able to find his own place in society in that way. I just read the most wonderful book called Motherwell by Deborah Orr, which goes into this in really beautiful detail. She was a woman who grew up probably about 12 miles away from where I grew up and 20 years before I did. But it really talks about the expectations that are placed on working class men and women that they also self-enforce in a lot of ways, and how that pushes through society to make it really hard to be other or to be anything outside of that.
I read a wonderful quote that you'd given recently, which was, "I think I'll always be inspired by gentle souls surviving in hard places."
Yeah, I think that is so true. It takes an awful lot of courage sometimes when the society doesn't want you to show tenderness or kindness or love or weakness. Certainly from the west coast of Scotland, and I think probably working class towns all over Britain, you know, men aren't really allowed to access their feelings. We're not allowed to talk about if we're feeling scared or vulnerable or hurt or confused or a bit lost in society. And so we are forced to internalize that. And I'm fascinated. It's a very ugly thing. It's a very ugly part of our society. But I'm kind of fascinated by what that does to men. And actually, what I'm writing now, the book I'm working on next, I hope really examines that, what it means to be a young boy growing in a society that always wants you to man up rather than to access your feelings.
You're a Scot living in the United States. Did you feel that you needed to leave Scotland or the United Kingdom to gain perspective on the society that you felt at odds with when you were growing up?
That's a really complicated question. And I think in a way, yes, and then also no. I'm very glad and fortunate to live in New York. I mean, New York's a wonderful city to live in, but I never knew my father. And after my mother died when I was in high school, I was just entirely untethered. There was nothing anchoring me in any place in Glasgow or in Scotland or in London even. And so in a funny way, I've washed up in New York. But hey, what a wonderful place to wash up if you're going to wash up anywhere. I've been in New York now for 20 years, and writing about Glasgow of the 80s from New York, part of it was a way to try and stitch myself back together as a person. I feel like I was a very different young boy than I am now as a man. And I didn't like that disconnect. I wanted to be a whole person. People didn't really understand me as a whole, you know, they saw me as two very different things. People understood me from my childhood, that knew me from my childhood, but then the people that knew me in New York knew me as a very different thing. And that is a very unsettling feeling for me. And then also writing about Glasgow from New York gave me a chance just to have a bit of a broader perspective. Distance is always good in art, I think, and it's always good to be able to step back and look over the whole sort of landscape and see the high points rather than perhaps writing it from really, really, truly on the inside.
And you are certainly the most British of the six shortlisted authors this year for the Booker Prize. I was wondering whether you feel any sense of flying the flag for the UK?
I'm a very proud Brit and I'm a really proud Scotsman. And so it would be hard not to feel like you were flying the flag. I fly that flag with pride. And even though I've lived in New York for 20 years, my Scottishness is not a coat. I don't just take it off and leave it. It informs absolutely everything, how I approach everything, how I think about everything. And also my family all live in Glasgow. So I'm home in Glasgow two or three times a year as often as I can. So if I am the only Brit on the list, then I'm very proud of that fact. But I'm also aware that there's so much fantastic Scottish fiction that doesn't get recognised every year. And so I feel a little bit of a responsibility to fly the flag for that. Shuggy is not a standalone book in that sense. He is one of many. And I just feel very lucky to have been recognised.
Now, we have talked about Scotland quite a lot. And one of the wonderful things about this book is the Glaswegian dialect that floods through it.
As a writer, one of my pleasures is actually writing dialogue. And I couldn't imagine writing a book about Glasgow without really leaning into Broad Scots or the Glaswegian dialect. I find it really sort of expressive and funny and oftentimes quite unsettling how sentences can go together. They can be incredibly tender, but they sound incredibly brutal, or they can be very sad, but they're incredibly funny. And so that was one of the great pleasures of writing the book. But the book actually has lots of different layers in it because, as I said earlier, the main character of Agnes Bain is sort of affecting airs and graces. She's not letting her neighbours, who she's absolutely identical to, believe that she is struggling in the same way that they are. And so she speaks in a very standard English, or a very Queen's English, because she wants to be perceived as above her neighbours. And so I even love the different levels of that and how that creates tension and how that creates separation between people who are identical. But when I first wrote the book, I wasn't thinking about the gaze of anyone else. I was thinking about writing it in honor of the people that I was writing about. And so in order to do that, you write with as much honesty as you can, and you write it as truthfully to the Glaswegian dialect as you can manage.
Well, the book has been wonderfully brought to life by Angus King, who really captures all those separate voices.
You'd worked for Kilfeathers for over a year. It was never meant to be that long. It was just that he had to feed himself and pay his own dig money each week, and the supermarket was the only business that would take him. Mr. Kilfeather was a parsimonious bastard. He liked to staff the shop with anyone he didn't have to pay a full adult wage, and Shuggy found himself able to take short shifts that fit around his patchy schooling. In his dreams, he always intended to move on. He had always loved to brush and play with hair. It was the only thing that made time truly fly. When he had turned 16, he had promised himself he would go to the hairdressing college that sat south of the River Clyde. He had gathered up all of his inspiration, the sketches he had copied from the Littlewoods catalogue and pages ripped from the Sunday magazines. Then he had gone to Cardonald to see about the evening classes. At the bus stop outside the college, he alighted with half a dozen 18-year-olds. They wore the newest, most fashionable gear and talked with a buzzing confidence that masked their own nerves. Shuggy walked half as fast as they did. He watched them go in the front door, then he recrossed the street to catch the bus going the other way. He started at Kilfeathers the following week.
Angus King, narrating Shuggy Bain, written by my guest, Douglas Stewart. Did you have anything to do with the selection of Angus King as the narrator of the book?
Oh, I was incredibly fortunate to have a role in the selection of the narrator of the book. My publisher actually sent me three options and three really fantastic readers. But Angus stuck out to me because he had such an expressive voice, and the book is populated by a real chorus of characters and also a lot of women. And I could tell just from the little clip that was submitted to me that he would be able to capture all the different levels of that and really bring them to life. You know, I think most writers, if they can, would love to narrate their own books. And I've certainly narrated a lot of my own short stories that were published in The New Yorker. But I just knew this task was beyond me because there are so many characters in the book. Because I think that's part of writing about working class Glasgow. You know, it's a collective moment. That how he remembers all of their inflections and their tones and their little tics and how they speak is really remarkable.
Blind and partially sighted readers are very fortunate that, because of the support of the Booker Foundation, accessible copies, including the audiobook version, have been made available to the RNIB library. One thing, unfortunately, we can't appreciate is the cover. So, for a blind audience, could you just describe the cover of the book?
Oh, it would be my honour. The cover of the book was actually a photograph that I chose myself. I was very fortunate to have a supportive publisher in that also. But it was a photograph that was taken in the 1980s, and it is of a little boy who is on the Easter House housing scheme in the East End of Glasgow. And in the background of the photograph are these very low council house flats. They're about four stories, but they're already falling into disrepair. It's very clear. And then as you sort of come into the foreground, there's sort of waste ground that is strewn with litter and just abandoned debris from the homes that surround it. And I should say it's a black and white photograph. In the very foreground is a washing pole that shoots straight up in the sky and then comes out into a T-bar at the top. And at the very top of that washing pole is a young boy who has climbed it to the very top. And he's gazing out across the landscape, gazing beyond the gaze of the reader. And there's a slight hope in his eyes and how he's looking into the far distance. But the photo can't also help but reference a crucifixion, the way he's holding on to the T-bar. But there's also a real sensitivity, and I wouldn't say he was an effeminate boy, but the way he's holding on to the bar and sort of cuddling it also lets you know that he is quite a tender soul. And then my publishers did a beautiful job where they take this bleak social photograph, but then they place in very bold, iconic letters over the top of it the title Shuggie Bane, which is in the most luminous gold foil. So it's quite a dazzling thing to behold and very, very striking.
Well, Douglas Stewart, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of Shuggie Bane, and many congratulations on being shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize.
Thank you very much, Red, and thank you for having me.
Like all the books shortlisted for this and previous year's Booker Prizes, Shuggie Bane is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Avni Doshi's debut novel, Burnt Sugar, is a frank and visceral exploration of a mother-daughter relationship gone sour. Set in India, it's one of four debut novels that has been shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. She joined me from her home in Dubai to tell me more about the book and the recognition that the Booker Prize has brought her.
Burnt Sugar is the story of a mother and daughter who have a very difficult relationship, and the mother develops Alzheimer's disease. And her daughter is now faced with a kind of dilemma. How does she look after this woman who never really was there for her when she was a child? And so it's a story about mothers and daughters and family. It's a story about being a caretaker for your elderly parent. It's a story about art. And it's also a story about betrayal.
Tara, the mother, followed her own path when she was her daughter's age. She ran away from a middle-class home in India and joined an ashram and experimented with free love. And all the way along, she had her infant daughter, Antara, who was just baggage rather than somebody she had a loving relationship with.
Yeah, when I was thinking about Tara, the mother character, I was thinking about the embodiment of desire. And what does desire look like when it's unbridled, unhampered? How does desire circulate in us as individuals, in society, within families? What happens when we are no longer hemmed in by societal expectations and can kind of act on our desires? And so it was a journey into thinking through what that kind of an individual would look like. And so she was actually a really interesting character to write, although a difficult individual for her daughter. But she was interesting because she goes against a lot of societal norms, particularly in the context of India.
And yet she has also become a mother. And I suppose the central question to the book is how much of a choice is motherhood for women in certain societies?
I think for both mother and daughter, there's a great deal of ambivalence around motherhood. Antara, the narrator, the daughter, she becomes a mother a bit later in the book. And even for her, it's a deeply troublesome question in a sense because of also the way she was mothered when she was young. And I was interested in drawing the connection between how mothering and being mothered inform one another. And in a sense, the question of motherhood doesn't begin and end with Antara and Tara in the book, because there are hints throughout that when Tara was growing up with her mother, Antara's grandmother, that also was a kind of difficult and trying relationship. So this is really intergenerational, this trauma between mothers and daughters.
Antara now is not only having to care for a mother who didn't appear to care for her, but she's also having to care for a young baby and experiencing postnatal depression.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's actually probably not a very uncommon experience for women of my generation, at least, because you see more and more that parents are living longer and longer and need to be looked after. And a lot of women are having children perhaps a bit later. And so you can sort of end up at this moment where you're not only looking after young children, but you're looking after parents who are struggling perhaps with degenerative diseases, who are aging, and so in a sense are perhaps more dependent on you in a way. And so I think she's found herself at this moment where she is a caretaker for the younger generation as well as the older one.
Yes, and I was very much struck by the echoes in her voice of her mother, Tara's voice. At one point, Tara has already said, "I knew having you would ruin my life." And then Antara is looking at her newborn baby and wishing the baby could become independent and that she herself could get some of her life back. It's a continuum.
It's interesting to me because when we see ourselves as children to our parents, we're always in that childlike role where we demand to be the center of their worlds. We demand attention. We're suddenly always vulnerable and we really see ourselves as such. And then on the other hand, I think when we become parents, some of that's forgotten. I don't know how much we can have a lot of empathy for our children based on our own upbringing. I think when we're in the role of parents, we automatically shift and we see ourselves as now the caretakers. We understand how much we're doing, how much we're sacrificing. But I wonder if we look back and think about perhaps what our parents sacrificed, are we really able to think through that fully? I don't know. You know, I don't know how much we can exist in both places at the same time.
Well, it's interesting that yours is one of four books on this year's Booker shortlist that deal with troublesome relationships between children and their parents. Do you think that's something of particular interest to millennial writers who have been brought up by very independent, liberal-minded parents and are wondering exactly what they're inheriting?
I definitely think that's a part of it. Also, this is a generation where we're really questioning how we are the product of this type of parenting. And we're really looking closely at how children are very much a product of their parents. I wonder to what degree past generations really believed this. And maybe I'm wrong about this, but I think to some degree there was an expectation that no matter how you were brought up, you would pull yourself up by your bootstraps or create your own destiny. And I think with this generation, there's a sense of the limitations that are put on you by your upbringing, and that there's an idea that you may actually never be able to escape from that. There's also a greater openness to blaming your parents for things. I don't know if in the past, previous generations dared to do that. There was perhaps, at least I think in the Indian context, there was too much respect for the parents' generation to really look at them in a critical light. But I think what Antara does in the novel is she really doesn't shy away from picking her mother apart and by extension, picking herself apart.
She certainly doesn't. And the book's opening line, "I would be lying if I said that my mother's misery had never given me pleasure," is a flag to the caustic voice that we're going to hear from Antara for the rest of the book. There's a great degree of wit and honesty to it, but there is an enormous amount of pain.
Yeah, and I think the wit and the honesty is perhaps part of the shield. It's like a coping mechanism also to some degree. I don't think it's possible for her to really cover up her pain. At one point, she goes to see her mother's doctor and she says, "My mother is leaking." And there's a sense that her mother can't be contained, that her mother is this all emotional, all powerful, all like an explosive quality to her mother that she finds extremely disturbing. And she tries to fashion herself in opposition to that, where she's very contained, hemmed in. She knows the parameters of who she is, the ends of her body are clear to her. She doesn't produce any strong smells. She prides herself on that, and that's very important to her, for her to differentiate herself from her mother, to create that separation. But the shadow side of that is that she is more like her mother than she really wants to admit, and that in fact we see as the novel progresses, as she becomes perhaps more and more unhinged, she has less and less control, and perhaps she never really had the control that she thought she did.
That's certainly picked up in the naming of the two characters, Antara. She is of Tara, but she is also Untara. She is desperately trying not to be her mother's daughter.
Yeah, and it was interesting for me when I selected the names, because Tara means stars and Antara means intimacy. So, you know, if you think of the distance of the stars, and then you think of the intimacy of Antara, of her voice as well. I was trying to create an intimacy in her voice that I was thinking about even when I named her.
And while we're on the subject of names, I know the book has a different title in India. Is there a reason for that?
So in India, the novel is called Girl in White Cotton. That was actually the original title that I had started with when I began writing this. I don't know, now it's been 8 years ago. And it was a really different book at that time, actually. But even the published form, White Cotton plays a kind of important role in the novel in terms of the fact that white cotton in the Indian context refers to grief. It refers to asceticism. In the ashram where Tara runs away to, they all wear white to show that they are separate from society, to show that they have renounced the world and are ready to move to a different plane of spiritual existence. And so in that context, I was thinking about white cotton as a way of understanding this outsider status, this grief that Antara experiences, as well as in terms of memory, because memory is an important theme in the novel, and I was thinking about it as a sort of tabula rasa. What is memory? Is memory really a blank slate, or is it a palimpsest? How does memory operate? So there were a lot of reasons why white cotton resonated a lot in the Indian context, where people would immediately recognize it as a sign of a grieving widow or of a family in mourning. But when we were looking to publish it around the world, white cotton wouldn't have the same resonance. And people would read Girl in White Cotton in a completely different way. When you think perhaps in the Western context of a girl in white cotton, you think of a young girl, you think of purity, you think of innocence. It's not really a strange image. It's actually a relatively common image. And it doesn't create the same tension in the title that it does in the context of Indian culture.
The book has been brought wonderfully to life by Vinita Rishi's superb narration. Did you have anything to do with the selection of her?
You know, I actually had no idea what went into creating an audiobook until the wonderful team at Penguin UK said, you know, we're making the audiobook and we have some actors. We'd like you to listen to them and tell us what you think. And as soon as we heard Vinita Rishi, my editor and I, as soon as we heard her reading, we knew that she had the right tone and she brought a seriousness and humor to the narrator's voice that really resonated for us. So yeah, it was really interesting and fun for me because I didn't really know all that went into the making of an audiobook.
I've noted down many things about my mother. The hour she falls asleep at night when her reading glasses slip down the greasy slide of her nose, or the number of Mazarin filos she eats for breakfast. I have been keeping track of these details. I know the skirted responsibilities and where the surface of story has been buffed smooth. Sometimes when I visit her, she asks me to phone friends who are long dead. My mother was a woman who could memorize recipes she had only read once. She could recall variations of tea made in other people's homes. When she cooked, she reached out for bottles and masalas without glancing up. Ma remembered the technique the Maimon neighbors used to kill goats during Bukra Eid on the terrace above her parents' old apartment, much to the Jane landlord's horror, and how the wire-haired Muslim tailor once gave her a rusty basin to collect the blood in. She described the metallic taste for me, and how she had licked her red fingers. "My first taste of non-veg," she said.
Vinita Rishi narrating Burnt Sugar, written by my guest, Avni Doshi. So, Avni, are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
Now I think I will be. I'm going to definitely give some a try. I had not until this point listened to any. But after being a little involved and hearing an audiobook for Burnt Sugar, I'm interested in listening to more, especially in terms of autobiography and memoir, because I think it would be wonderful to hear those books in the voice of the person who's writing them.
And have you started work on a second novel yet, or are you still enjoying the shortlisting for the Booker Prize?
I've been really busy, actually, with two young children and, of course, all the wonderful press and attention from the Booker. It's actually kept me really busy. So I haven't been able to start anything new, but I'm hoping to start something before the end of the year, fingers crossed. And I'm sure it will be a novel. I'm not sure I know how to write anything else.
Well, I hope it doesn't take another 8 years and that you'll come back onto the show to talk about it in the future.
Absolutely, I absolutely will.
In the meantime, Avni Doshi, thank you so much for coming onto the show and taking us into the world of Burnt Sugar.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now it's back to Polly Crosby for the books of her life. Polly, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
There were lots. I read so much as a child. I think one of the ones that really stuck with me was The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett, because it got these amazing secrets that I love in books, and the way that you follow along with the main character to try and work out what's going on. I love anything that includes landscape and countryside. So the idea of a giant garden popped away just set my mind on fire.
When Mary Lennox was sent to Misselthwaite Manor to live with her uncle, everybody said she was the most disagreeable-looking child ever seen. It was true, too. She had a little thin face and a little thin body, thin light hair, and a sour expression. Her hair was yellow, and her face was yellow because she had been born in India and had always been ill in one way or another. Her father had held a position under the English government and had always been busy and ill himself, and her mother had been a great beauty who cared only to go to parties and amuse herself with gay people. She had not wanted a little girl at all, and when Mary was born she handed her over to the care of an ayah, who was made to understand that if she wished to please the Memsahib, she must keep the child out of sight as much as possible. So when she was a sickly, fretful, ugly little baby, she was kept out of the way. And when she became a sickly, fretful, toddling thing, she was kept out of the way also.
John Curl, narrating The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, I think being able to reread a book, the book has to be particularly special, and one that I get so much comfort from is I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith. It's set in Suffolk and it was a real inspiration for The Illustrated Child. And it's just the most beautiful historical coming of age novel I've ever read.
I write this sitting in the kitchen sink. That is, my feet are in it. The rest of me is on the draining board, which I've padded with our dog's blanket and the tea cosy. I can't say that I'm really comfortable, and there is a depressing smell of carbolic soap, but this is the only part of the kitchen where there is any daylight left, and I have found that sitting in a place where you've never sat before can be inspiring. I wrote my very best poem while sitting on the hen house, though even that isn't a very good poem. I've decided my poetry is so bad that I mustn't write any more of it.
Candida Gubbins narrating I Captured the Castle by Dodie Smith, which is available from the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I've actually listened to this one recently. It's Lanny by Max Porter, and it's the most stunning bit of work. It's eerie and weird and unusual and secretive, and the way it's done in audiobook is just incredible, really. It feels like you're submerged in the book. It's amazing.
If I get the 7:21, I miss breakfast with Lanny, but I avoid Carl Taylor and usually get a seat. If I get the 7:41, I'll see Lanny, but Carl Taylor will find me on the platform and I'll have to hear about Susan Taylor and the clever Taylor girls and which subjects they're doing for GCSE, and we'll probably have to stand. Someone's armpit, someone's fold-up bike, Carl Taylor's trundling news feed mixing with someone's tinny headphone music. Down the village street, hit the bowl of the crossroads good and fast for a belly wobble, up Ghost Pilot Lane, through Ashcote, dual carriageway all the way into town. Assuming there are no tractors or cyclists, I can be at the station in under 20 minutes. My personal best is 14. If I slow down on Ghost Pilot Lane, there might be deer on the road, and I can stop for a minute and watch them. Or I can honk to warn them I'm coming and hit 70 or 80, windows down to blast myself awake and enjoy the car. I may as well enjoy the car. It cost me enough, and it spends most of its life parked, waiting for me. Sometimes, if I've driven fast, I have 5 minutes in the station car park, and I sit and talk to my vehicle. "Thank you," I'll say. "Pleasure doing business with you, sir. Nice one, mate. Bucephalus, you absolute beauty, you're the best horse ever." This is what commuting is. Small pleasures coaxed from playing the routine like a game. Little tricks of the part-time countryman.
Lanny by Max Porter is read by a cast of narrators and is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. Well, Polly Crosby, thank you so much for sharing your obvious passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. My thanks to producer Hannah, and we hope that you'll join us at the same time next week. In the meantime, don't forget, you can catch up on almost 200 previous episodes of the show by downloading our podcast. Just search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at Talking_Books. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.